Today's speaker is Bob Hackett. And I was going to begin by saying that everybody knows Bob, and in some sense that's absolutely true because he has been a colleague of ours for some time, and some of you have taken courses with him, and some of you have, all of the faculty here have had a chance to work with him a bit. But in another sense, you can work with people a very long time before you have a good sense of what it is they do. And we used to have, at one point in somebody else's period of being chair, we used to have actually colloquia of the faculty who came forward and told people in formal ways what it was they did. And that was terrific because even some of their fellow faculty didn't know that until they heard it from in a formal setting. So this is an opportunity for people who know Bob to get a sense of what it is he does in a kind of a formal way, and to interview him even though you think you may know him, and ask him a series of questions that you wouldn't normally ask as you walk down the hall and say hi and good morning and how are things going. And I would like to encourage you to take the opportunity to take the time and meet with Bob in the same interviews that you would do with somebody who came from outside, because I am sure that there is as much to learn on all sides from this opportunity as there is with any other candidate. So, without further lecturing, I'll turn it over to Bob. And the topic of his colloquia is Peace News and Nukes Speak.
Well, it's a catchy title. It may not bear on what I'm actually going to say.
Okay, let you say it.
Okay, thanks, Sarah. Yes, I am glad to have this opportunity, actually, to tell you about my research, because, as Leora says, even though this is my third year here, there always isn't a lot of opportunities to discuss the work we're actually doing. And I would like to report on a research project which is in progress. I've got to emphasize that this is not a completed construction. In a sense, it's like trying to describe a baby while you're still pregnant. And I use that analogy because, as many of you know, we had an infant daughter, obviously an infant, born last June. And if Sigmund Freud were a woman, I think he would have said that men suffer from womb envy. And in a sense, this project... He did say that? Okay. Good. I think there's something to it, because this project was conceived at about the same time as my daughter, and I think it's sort of my way of being creative while my wife creates a human being. But what I want to emphasize is that this is not yet a completed entity. And so what I'm going to say is to tell you something about how the research was conceptualized and also what kinds of findings seem to be emerging. And I want to, before I go any further, to say that the research has been divided into several phases, each of which, on average, involves several hundreds of hours of work, and I owe a great deal to dedicated and qualified graduate and senior undergraduate research assistants from this department. Without the help of people like Amparo and Miles and Allison or Ingrid, Suzanne, Randy, and Pam, and others, this work couldn't have been done. And I doubt that it could have been done as effectively at any other university department in Western Canada, just given the pool of people who are high-caliber people who are available in this department. Well, the basic research question that I posed, two of them really, two related questions, are first, to what extent and in what ways do accounts in the Canadian daily press, daily newspapers, reflect, amplify, inflect, and or challenge Cold War ideology? And conversely, how much of an opening exists in the press for the articulation of alternative or oppositional discourses? That's obviously a huge question. And I've chosen really to slice into it in several different ways, using several different kinds of methods. Primarily looking at newspaper content or texts, although I did also do a number of interviews with journalists and their sources regarding the production of what I've chosen to call peace and security news. news related to matters of national and international peace and security. And what I would like to say is how I, before I go any further, is just how I see this fitting into the literature, as we call it, particularly in media studies. I think in several ways this would represent a contribution to the literature. One is, firstly, there's a general lack of studies, I think, regarding Canadian media content in general. And I feel that this work will represent a significant contribution simply in describing patterns of content in Canadian news media. There is a growing but still small body of literature on the relationship between mass communication and international peace and indeed human survival. I guess that's the bottom line, the relationship between mass communication and the prospects for peace and survival in the nuclear age. That's still a small body of literature, and especially in the Canadian context, there's little work in that area. And I feel this will be a contribution there as well. More specifically, to the extent that I have looked at relationships between journalists and their sources as a key aspect of the production of news, this is also a contribution insofar as a number of people, for example, Herbert Gans, an American media sociologist, have said that this is one of the most under-researched areas currently in news media studies. And finally, I suppose the results are relevant to a kind of ongoing debate between what we might call critical versus liberal or pluralist paradigms in media studies regarding what factors shape media texts and what are the actual patterns of meaning or significance of those texts. So that by way of background, what I want to turn to now are some of the ways in which I conceptualize the study. It grows out of theoretical concerns in media studies rather than, for example, international relations or peace studies. It grows out of concerns from media studies, and I want to identify four key concepts or assumptions from media studies that have informed this research. The first such assumption is that, yes, Virginia, it does make a difference. In other words, I feel that it is important how and to what extent the media report to us, to the public, questions of war and peace, of disarmament, of the peace movement, the arms race, and so on. So I would argue that the content or the news agenda or the interpretations embedded in media texts do indeed make a difference to political outcomes, and ultimately, however indirectly, to the chances for human survival in the nuclear age. Well, how do we conceive of what difference it makes? Unfortunately, it seems that critical media scholars, people from the so-called critical paradigm, have until relatively recently tended to avoid doing much empirical work on media impact or media outcomes. So we have to look to the more, if you like, behavioral tradition for clues as to what difference the media make, however narrowly conceptualized they think of media impact. And one model which I think is at least pointing us in useful directions is the so-called agenda-setting model. And the basic idea of that is that media may not be successful in telling us what to think, but they are stunningly successful in telling us what to think about. So in other words, the media develop agendas for their audience. The media select from a wide range of possible issues and topics, and by giving them differential emphasis and attention, the media define for the audience the relative importance of each. And I think that's especially true of areas of social life where audiences lack direct experience. There's also a sort of a converse theory or model to agenda setting. That's the notion of the spiral of silence, which centers on the media's ability to remove from public view and discussion certain issues and topics. So I think that theories like that, however narrowly conceptualized they are and whatever their limits, do point to the importance of media in providing us, the media audiences, with a stock of information and images which structure audience perceptions of the world beyond their own immediate experience. And for most of us, concepts or processes like the arms race, hostile regimes, terrorism, and foreign wars are something that are not part of our immediate experience. So this work is fruitful in suggesting that media images do indeed have effectivity, and that they work more by structuring our cognition or our perceptions than by having direct impact on our attitudes and values and so on. Yet I think we have to recognize flaws in the agenda-setting model. It doesn't say much about specific content or the nuances of the cultural meanings created. It doesn't ask how the media agenda is set in the first place, typically. It treats audiences as aggregates of individuals rather than as, for example, social movements or interpretive communities. And it assumes that what constitutes an issue, so-called, is unproblematic, and that the work of the media is simply to select and emphasize some issues rather than others, whereas I would argue that, in fact, the media work in part to define and fix the very definitions or limits of issues. Now, though this particular research is not a study of media impact, it does try in a preliminary way to both draw on the agenda-setting model and to address some of its weaknesses. So that's the first kind of, if you like, concept or assumption for media studies in which I've drawn. A second is the idea that the media are part of a power structure of society and that they crucially depend on various institutions and interest groups as sources of information. And Stuart Hall and others argue that the relationship can be seen as follows, that journalists are oriented towards sources who are available, articulate, who have power, legitimacy, expertise, and or representative status, and who can generate useful knowledge, which is consistent with everyday understandings of the world, and doesn't need a lot of time-consuming verification. So what kinds of sources are we talking about here? Most typically, it would be state and governmental institutions, courts, police, political parties, at least the dominant electoral parties, commercial agencies, established interest groups, and so on. The routine activity of news production is heavily dependent on and directed towards these official and accredited sources and their representatives. So therefore, the media help to sustain, as it were, a hierarchy of credibility in which those in powerful or high status positions in society are likely to have their interpretive frameworks and their very definitions of social reality reproduced and translated by the media. Such sources become, in effect, the primary definers of issues and events. Now, such primary definitions are not monolithic or univocal. There is a space for legitimated opposition. Rather, the primary definitions set the terms of debate so that subsequent contributions to debate on the issue are judged as reasonable or relevant in relation to them. The media, in this conception, act basically as secondary definers, inflecting and translating the primary definitions into a language or idiom acceptable to their own audiences. So that's the second notion, the notion of primary definers. A third and rather closely related concept is that the media draw on various discourses which are generated, as it were, outside the media in order to report and to make sense of events and issues. But they draw on these competing discourses, as it were, in an unequal way. These discourses do not make themselves felt in an equal manner. Rather, the media structure them in dominance. They are hierarchically organized, as it were, so that some are more credible or legitimate than others. So if we accept that the media are doing their work in a kind of, if you like, a discursive terrain, it helps to have at least a kind of map or sketch of that terrain. And to do that, I haven't done a lot of research on the whole, discursive terrain of the Cold War, but I have come up with a sketch that I have found quite useful in guiding the research. And to begin with, since I've used the term Cold War ideology in the title of this talk, I guess it would be useful to at least offer some kind of definition of it. And I found that although it may be perhaps a bit arrogant or risks a certain amount of simplification, I felt that it would be possible to reduce this whole enormous apparatus of military spending and potential extermination to a single 14-word proposition. That's probably a bit audacious on my part, but if I've piqued your interest, let me try it out on you. And that proposition is that to maintain peace and freedom, we must be strong in order to deter them. Now, that proposition implies a number of essentially contested concepts and propositions, and political struggle in language, after all, aims to fix their meanings and win consent to those concepts and propositions. So if we look at that proposition a little more closely, if you'll accept that as a kind of quintessential statement of classic Cold War ideology, you'll see that it defines peace as being consistent with a permanent state of terror, as being consistent with militarized economies, with vast gulfs of unmet human social needs, and with wars in the Third World which have killed millions of people since 1945. Freedom is defined so that the free world can include countries like South Korea and Chile. Strength is equated with nuclear arsenals and military high technology. The term must be strong suggests that this position, this ideology, tries to claim the ground of realism. There's no realistic alternative. Deterrence, there's the notion of to deter. There's a whole growing body of literature on the strategic doctrine, what some people would call a theology of deterrence. But what interests me especially is the operation of we versus them. It seems to me that that is particularly crucial. A kind of Manichaean view of the world divided into us, the good, versus them, the evil, in which we are defined as pluralistic and diverse, but unified around basic democratic values and freedoms, and there's no, without fundamental divisions of interest or class. They are defined as both different and threatening, and indeed perhaps threatening by virtue of their difference. Now, they, who's they? Well, I think anybody in this room could answer that question. The Soviet Union, the Soviet expansionist, the evil empire. I think, though, in a sense, we have to introduce a little bit of historical context. I think that the Second Cold War, beginning around 1980, is a little bit different from the original Cold War of the 1940s and 50s, in that the enemy is now more closely identified with the Soviet Union rather than with communism in general as an ideological force. And there's another difference, too, perhaps, in that the internal target of Cold War ideology is not just radical dissent, but also, to some extent, the liberal detente wing of what has been called the foreign policy establishment. So that, if you like, if you'll accept that as a statement of classic Cold War ideology, I think in Canada it's inflected in important ways by the notion of Canada as a middle power. Canada is a Western democratic country which has special responsibilities and a special relationship to the United States, but Canada, after all, isn't a nuclear power and it's not one of these superpowers. Now, this notion of Canada as a middle power can itself be taken in different directions. I think that one part of it is the idea of Canada as a peacemaker or a peacekeeper rather than an arms manufacturer. Although since 1945, one can argue that Canada has been intimately involved with the American nuclear arsenal, I think that probably the dominant image that Canadians have of their own country is that Canada is a, if you like, a peacekeeper in international affairs. It can even lead to a position of moral superiority to the United States, a certain sense of distancing to the U.S., which in our perhaps somewhat smug view tends to get carried away in world affairs. Gwynne Dyer, I think, calls it the naughty uncle syndrome. Is that, Simon, if that's the term that he uses? that we have a tendency, you know, the United States is still part of the family, but it does get carried away at times. Another aspect of this notion of Canada as a special middle power is that peace can easily be defined as a question of arms control between the superpowers, and therefore it's up to the superpowers, and therefore it can become a kind of alibi for Canada and Canadians doing nothing. I think there's a kind of interesting parallel there. You know, if we define peace as being an issue out there for the superpowers to resolve, we don't have to do anything, there's not much we can do. There's a kind of similarity with the ideological notion that politics is something that happens out there and doesn't involve us. That politics is what politicians do, and we're outside that sphere, that whole arena. It's what they do to us. Okay, so that's how I see Cold War ideology being inflected in the specific Canadian context. We also have to recognize the existence of what Rob Walker in Victoria has called the discourse of dissent. And he's usefully distinguished between three kinds of critique, or three strands within the discourse of anti-militarist dissent. Each of these strands has its own characteristics, strengths, and weaknesses. And these three strands are as follows. First, a universalist moral argument, which varies from pacifism to religious and secular globalism, which emphasizes the underlying community of humanity. Secondly, a more radical socio-economic critique, which leads to a more politically pointed and radical analysis of the roots of militarism in social structures and interests. And thirdly, a strategic geopolitical argument, which emerges from within and accepts many of the basic assumptions of military and policy institutions. But at the same time, it offers a critique of specific weapon systems or specific strategic doctrines. So that's a little bit lengthy perhaps, but that's the third kind of assumption or background that I've taken from media studies, the idea that the media take these contending discourses and then structure them in dominance, hierarchically as it were. The fourth and final idea that I've taken from media studies as a kind of guide to this particular body of research is the notion of interpolation, if you like, as a key mechanism of ideology, including Cold War ideology. And this really involves several ideas, which are perhaps a little difficult to get across, but let me give it a stab anyway. I think any of you who are doing textual analysis or who have studied concepts of ideology in popular culture will be familiar by now with the idea that texts and indeed whole ideologies work primarily perhaps through inviting readers or speakers to position themselves in certain ways to in effect adopt certain identities in relation to the text in order to make sense of it. You're probably familiar with Althusser's idea that ideology is the mechanism that turns individuals into subjects who feel themselves to be knowing, thinking human beings, the originators of their actions, and so on. And the political theorist Ernesto Laclau has suggested that the unity of an ideological discourse, its very principle of cohesion, is the interpolated subject. And what he means by interpolation is the notion of hailing people or addressing them, positioning you. Hey, you. You're addressed in certain ways. Okay, so that's one important idea. The notion that that narratives, texts, including news stories, if they're telling a story, must be telling a story to somebody. So that there is a conception of the audience, a positioning of the audience, at least implicit in news stories. A second and related idea is that the construction of an image of an alien other may well be a basic element in the very constitution of culture, at least in Western societies. The definition of our society, or our culture, or our community, is offered by contrast as something distinct from theirs, the other, their community, their culture. And I think that you can interpret or analyze the whole set of competing discourses about the Cold War in terms of how they try to interpolate their potential subjects. Cold War ideology, classical Cold War ideology, depends on addressing us as the West, as NATO, as the democratic countries and so on, versus them, the Soviets, totalitarian, expansionist, the evil empire, and so on. The various strands within the discourse of dissent attempt other positions or interpolations, so that the universalist anti-militarist critique addresses us as the global human community and tries to get rid of the notion of an alien other altogether, it seems to me. The more radical socio-economic critique of militarism addresses us as oppressed groups within Canada versus the ruling class, or American imperialism, or the military-industrial complex, or institutions of patriarchy, or whatever. It'll vary with the particular position. And another possible position is to address us as Canada as something distinct from the nuclear superpowers. So the idea here is that it's very useful in doing textual analysis, which is the bulk of my research, it's useful to try and identify in various ways the conception of the audience or the positioning of the audience, which is implicit in the storytelling of journalists. Well, out of time constraints, there are, as I say, about six or seven stages of the research. I'm just going to extremely briefly tell you what they are and then focus on one or two of them. The first phase of the research basically involved interviews with journalists and their actual or potential sources, people who were most centrally involved in producing news relevant to defense and military affairs, to foreign affairs, to the disarmament movement, and so on. And the basic interest there was, how does the media's own agenda get set? Who are the primary definers? And if we have time later in the discussion, I can come back and talk about some of the tentative findings in that area. A second huge stage of the research was, probably my last time I'll do this, but it was a content analysis of three samples of newspaper items taken from last spring. It totaled about 3,000 items, and my poor research assistants took the brunt of it, and I don't think I'll put them through that kind of travail again. I think that this probably, I'll say it publicly, this is probably my last quantitative content analysis. Okay, you can take it almost as a promise, almost. So again, we can talk about how I did that if you're interested later on. How we did that. I shouldn't take the credit for the massive amount of labor that went into it. The results are still sitting in the womb of the computer, so I can't tell you a great deal about specific findings, but I can tell you what I would expect to emerge from it. The third stage is what I call the brutal dictatorship section of the research. It was, at the level of the news agenda, the overall news agenda, looking at raising the question of whether a Cold War Manichaeanism, a Cold War dichotomy between us and them, influences Canadian newspaper coverage of dictatorial regimes which systematically violate their own citizens' human rights. If Cold War ideology does influence the patterns of attention to dictatorial regimes, we would expect that friendly regimes like American client states or countries in the free world should, all other things being equal, be treated more favorably than hostile and or communist regimes. And again, we can talk about that later if you're interested. Another stage of the research, this is going to the opposite end of the spectrum from that kind of quantitative approach, was a close-up linguistic analysis using tools taken from people like Gunther Kress or John B. Thompson of a single item. I have to thank Allison and Miles in particular for their dissection, their minute dissection of a single article and producing about 20 pages of notes based on that one article. Again, I won't talk about this in detail, and we can come back to it later, but I want to mention it because to show that we used a variety of techniques. It's an approach in which I chose to use different methods to come at the same kind of question, Cold War ideology. I also did a study which is somewhere in between the quantitative and the close-up linguistic approach of the American raid on Libya last year and media treatment of interpretations and reactions to that raid, to that event. And again, I'd like, if possible, to talk about that one later on. What I'd like to focus most of the attention on today is one of the studies which is closest to being complete, and that is the Vancouver newspaper framing of Vancouver's annual Walk for Peace. Perhaps it's particularly timely because that's coming up again, that annual event, in about 2 weeks' time. And I chose this partly because this is where we might expect to find relatively sympathetic coverage in the media of an alternative or oppositional discourse, that of the peace movement. And it was, of course, not possible in practical terms to analyze the peace movement as a whole, so we chose the annual Walk for Peace. That choice has both disadvantages and advantages. Amongst the advantages are that it is the largest single peace event staged each year in Canada. It brings together various strands of the movement and offers a good test of which ones the media choose to emphasize. It is a newsworthy event and attracts a lot of coverage. And because it's annual and therefore predictable, the media have a wide range of choices regarding how to cover it. They could, for example, use it as a peg for background features. Well, this section of the research drew extensively from Todd Gitlin's analysis. Many of you may have seen his book, The Whole World is Watching, an analysis of the relationship between the Students for a Democratic Society and the American mainstream media in the 1960s. And we, in particular, used his notion of media framing devices to organize our own approach to the media materials. And he defines media frames as persistent patterns of cognition, interpretation, and presentation, of selection, emphasis, and exclusion, by which symbol handlers routinely organize discourse. So really what he's doing is a kind of qualitative content analysis. But Gitlin, I think, rightly suggests that there's no single set of media contents which characterize media images of SDS. And that's linked to his perspective that both the dominant social ideology as well as the specific occupational ideology of journalism, both of them are flexible and constantly challenged and negotiated. You can't, as it were, retake a newspaper and read between the lines and say, look, there it is, there's dominant ideology. Look, I found it, it's right there, it's under my microscope. It doesn't work quite that way. Ideology is something more like a matrix which can generate a number of different possibilities, but always with limits and constraints to them. So he looks at media frames in the context of a developing historical relationship between the New Left as an anti-militarist movement and the media. And to some extent, we tried to take that approach ourselves within the serious limits of time and resources available to us. So we kept that historical dimension in mind, and we examined media coverage each year from the very inception of the walk in 1980 until last year. We also interviewed at least several key organizers of the walk, as well as several journalists. But as I say, there's still much more work I'd like to do in that area. But I think that I can suggest the outlines of the kind of argument that is emerging. So based on our monitoring of the media coverage over the last 6 or 7 years, we found that there was little evidence of the specific negative media frames which Gitlin found to be applied to SDS and the anti-Vietnam War movement in general. with the possible partial exceptions of a certain amount of trivialization of the walk, a certain amount of disparagement by numbers, as it were, perhaps undercounting the attendance, a certain amount of attention to pro-militarist arguments juxtaposed against the walk, and a certain amount of attention, especially in the columnists, and if you think about who are the columnists in the Vancouver Sun and Province, it's not that surprising, a certain amount of attention to the communist dupe theme. You know, we're playing into the hands of the Russians by going out and taking a Sunday stroll with thousands of other people to protest the arms race. But it's not surprising that you would find major differences between SDS in the 60s and the End the Arms Race Coalition's relations with the media. It's not surprising, given that in very general terms, the nuclear disarmament issue in Canada in the 1980s is very different from the Vietnam War in the United States in the 60s. And here are some of the differences. Well, the peace issue today in Canada does not force the same kind of personal choices or divisions or personal losses as did the draft and the Vietnam War to Americans. So the issue is relatively less salient. The peace issue is not as prominent in Canadian politics as Vietnam was in the U.S. of the 60s. Also, the Canadian peace movement does not pose the same kind of implied threat to national security or insult to national honor as the anti-Vietnam War movement did. Indeed, the Canadian peace movement can, with some validity, I think, claim the mantle of nationalism. The Canadian peace movement can, with some credibility, claim to be protecting Canadian sovereignty from the United States. Furthermore, militarism is not as strongly rooted in the economy and popular culture of Canada. And then there's the whole idea that I suggested earlier of Canada as a middle power rather than a nuclear superpower. So it's easier for Canadians to say, well, this isn't primarily our responsibility, peace isn't really a Canadian issue. I think for all those reasons, we would expect to find important differences between the 1960s and the 1980s and between the SDS and the arms race relations with the media. And of course, there's also specific differences between those two organizations, differences of goals, purpose, strategy, tactics, structure, support base, and constituency. One might suggest that as a narrowly based organization with a commitment to quick and radical social change, SDS was highly dependent on the media to amplify its message, whereas End the Arms Race, which I'll call EAR for short, is a broad-based coalition dedicated to specific goals and with a wider variety of communication options available to it. So it's not surprising that EAR has not suffered the same kind of negative framing as SDS did in the 60s. And indeed, apart from opinion columns, the coverage in the Vancouver papers has on the whole been fairly supportive. But, and this is where I think we get to a big question, supportive of what? How many, can I just ask how many people, by the way, have been involved in the peace walk at one time or another? I mean, are most of you familiar with the event? Yeah, probably most of you. And you've presumably got your own impressions of newspaper and or TV coverage or interpretation of the event. And I'd certainly welcome, you know, your own comments and impressions in terms of how this interpretation makes sense to you. I just want to jump back and look a bit historically, because it seems to me that in terms of how the media have framed the event, there appear to have been three phases through which that relationship has evolved. In 1980 and 81, the rally itself was quite small by comparison with later years. Only, what, a couple of thousand people showed up, and it was treated basically as just another isolated political protest. A relatively high amount of attention, especially in the Sun, was given to the actual substance of the protest, statements from speakers, and so on. In 82 and 83, the rally becomes certified as a major event. In 1982, for the first time, multiple items, like columns and backgrounders, are pegged to the event. And the historical significance of the large turnout, I mean 35,000 suddenly showed up in 1982, the large turnout of those years means that all subsequent marches are going to be spoken of not in terms of themselves alone, but as part of an ongoing yearly ritual. And by 1984, this is what I would consider to be the third stage, the city, the Vancouver City Council itself, has endorsed the walk, and that gives it even more legitimacy. By then, the walk has been signified as a certified regular community ritual. It's no longer defined according to the repertoire of stereotypes associated with the category political protest. Rather, at least in the Vancouver newspapers, it has become Vancouver's very own walk for peace. It's ours. It's something that the community can take pride in and celebrate. But at the same time, as the framing of the event has shifted from political protest to regular community ritual, the focus of the coverage has shifted from the political substance of speeches to the festive-like atmosphere of the event itself. Although, to be sure, last year, EAR was able to re-inject a little bit of political content into news coverage by organizing a week-long peace symposium to precede the actual walk. But my argument, in part, rests on identifying themes which were minimized or absent in the coverage, say, of last year's event, but which were emphasized in alternative accounts of the event, in political newspapers, for example. And these are some of the missing themes, if you want to think of them that way, from the coverage of the last couple of years of the Peace Walk. First, and perhaps crucially, EAR's call in 1986 for no Canadian collaboration in SDI, the American Star Wars program, was virtually ignored by the press, even though EAR had intended that to be its major theme for the Peace Walk. Other missing themes include the conversion of military-related production to peaceful uses, which were the themes of speeches at the symposium, the links between the Vancouver Peace Walk and marches and rallies occurring in other towns in BC and elsewhere in Canada. Without mentioning such simultaneous rallies elsewhere, it's easier to frame the walk as a community event rather than as part of a broader social and political movement. Fourthly, the Vancouver province failed to refer altogether to the Vancouver peace proposals, which were intended by the organizers to highlight both the symposium and the Walk for Peace. They were presented, if you may recall from last year, at BC Place by a number of prominent speakers that End the Arms Race had brought in. It appears that the province just ignored that. The province was wrapped up in treating this as a sort of a festival. Perhaps it's not too surprising coming from the province, but even the Sun gave relatively little space to the substance of the peace proposals. There is little analysis of the reasons or the political positions which led walkers to participate, and there was not much attention paid to the significance of the fact that the walk involved cooperation, even a coalition, which involved widely dissimilar movements and institutions. I think that that has a political significance that has been underplayed or not really noticed in the press. So in the place of those missing themes, if you like, we have emphasis on angles and aspects of the walk such as the following. Journalists put on how many people showed up this year. So for each year, the walk is compared with the previous year's attendance. And interestingly, it appears that that can sometimes be used as a negative framing device, as when only 50,000 people showed up in 1986, by comparison with 1984. And I would suggest that such negative framing by numbers, if you like, seems to be especially prominent in newspapers outside of BC. Just to take one simple example, in 1984, the Globe and Mail reported the crowd turnout as somewhere between 30,000 and 115,000, somewhere in there. Okay. Depending whether they use the police estimates or a casual statement made by one of the organizers that, oh, I think there were about 115,000 people out there. And that was adopted at the time as one of the crowd size estimates. Well, what's interesting is that in later years, it was that casual higher estimate that was taken as the gospel truth. This year, only 60,000 people came out compared to last year's record of 115,000. Very, very interesting kind of way in which the event has become framed. So that's the emphasis on numbers, and sometimes as a way of denigrating the walk has been one of the themes. Another is an emphasis on human interest angles, especially in the Vancouver province in recent years. So angles like the participation of children, or colorful costumes, or a photo of a child sitting on Santa Claus. What you have to recognize is that coverage is fairly supportive of the event and serves to mainstream rather than to marginalize the walkers. At the same time, it deflects attention away from disarmament as a political issue. A third theme, which I think is interesting, is an emphasis in a number of articles on the walk as a nonpartisan and hence by implication a non-political event. They'll point, for example, to the attendance by liberals and as well as Cope and Vancouver's NDP-ish mayor, ex-mayor, thank you, as evidence that this is a nonpartisan event and therefore, in the words of some journalists, is non-political. Now, of course, what is at stake there is a fairly narrow definition of politics as competition between electoral parties, rather than broader definitions which focus on how social power structures are maintained or challenged through a wide range of practices, including in daily life. I would argue that narrow definition of politics is quite consistent with how politics is defined generally in the media. A fourth theme that's implicit in some of the coverage is a juxtaposition between, on the one hand, peaceful, moderate, reformist, responsible, large-scale and mainstream and hence legitimate protest versus angry, violent, small minority, extremist and or illegitimate protest on the other. So there are legitimate and illegitimate forms of protest, and if there are large numbers of people showing up, therefore it must be a legitimate protest. I think that such oppositions and assumptions seem to underlie one of the phrases that was used in, I think, 1982 to apply to the peace walk, that it was a peaceful protest, which implies obviously a background assumption that violence might have been expected. You don't see phrases in the papers like a peaceful election campaign or a peaceful day in Parliament today. And it's interesting because, indeed, since 1982, the notion that they no longer have to qualify the peace walk as being a peaceful event, that phrase has disappeared because it's now, I would argue, so mainstream and so legitimated that there's no longer even the background assumption that violence might occur. And finally, another theme which is emphasized in the press coverage is that questions since 1983, questions of the political effectiveness of the walk and the peace movement in general, have been submerged. Now, there's several possible explanations for that. It might be that journalists are quite sympathetic to the peace movement in the Vancouver area and that they would find it too depressing to dwell on the relative failures of the peace movement in the last few years. But I think that a more convincing case can be made that as the walk has become appropriated as an annual community ritual, a festive event, a celebration, the question of its political effectiveness simply becomes less relevant. So I would argue that the Vancouver dailies in recent years have given the walk positive and upbeat coverage for the most part, excluding for a moment the columnists and their rabid political views. I should also mention, by the way, a change in the narrative style. I haven't really analyzed this, but I plan to. It was suggested to me by a journalist at The Sun that as the walk has become mainstreamed and legitimated, reporters have more liberty to use their own words to describe the event in supportive ways, to talk about the exhilaration that people feel, or the basic atmosphere of the event can be described in supportive ways by journalists in their own words, very much by contrast with how they would treat, for example, a controversial event like the solidarity demonstrations of 5 years ago. That is, I think, a really key contrast, which I haven't really looked at yet, but would be worth doing. When you had, I wasn't here, but I imagine about 50,000 people showing up at solidarity demonstrations. 35 to 250,000 or whatever people showed up. And they were making very pointed political statements that were divisive within the community, and that I think the press coverage would be quite significantly different of those events. So we get upbeat coverage in the Vancouver press, and even though there's been a relative decline in attendance in the last couple of years compared to the possibly fictional figure of 115,000 3 years ago, the Vancouver papers seem anxious not to use those apparent facts to undermine the importance of the walk. So we have, for example, The Province 2 years ago saying that early morning rain may have kept the number of marchers well below last year's record of 115,000, but it didn't dampen the spirits of those who braved the unpredictable spring weather. So the people, you know, they're treated as very brave people for taking the chance of getting showered on. It's a kind of supportive frame. And The Sun did likewise, you know, attributing lower turnouts not to the unimportance of the issue, but to the weather, or last year to the simultaneous opening of Expo, in the context of generally upbeat coverage. Now, I think there's an interesting contrast to be made here with the national media, or the media outside of BC, which don't have to worry about antagonizing a British Columbian audience, right? Because in contrast to the Vancouver papers, the attention of papers outside BC to the event has waned. So last year in, 15 major Canadian dailies east of the Rockies that we looked at, there were only 3 items in total mentioning the Peace Walk, by comparison with a dozen or so in the Sun and Province. And while we didn't look at coverage outside of BC prior to last year, my impression is that the walk and the Canadian peace movement in general is declining in newsworthiness outside of BC. And that impression is supported by statements from interviews with senior editorial people in Toronto-based regional or national, so-called national, media. And let me just give you 2 or 3 of these statements. One, it seems that the Peace Walk is regarded as an event of regional rather than national significance, and one which reflects the peculiarities of BC's political culture. One editor told me, in so many words, he said, "Forgive me, but Vancouver, well, it's just not like the real world." Okay, please don't take this personally, but I have real reservations about people in Vancouver. Okay, so it's just what we do, you know, and some of the Eastern media sometimes have emphasized that the walk starts at one beach, ends up at another beach, just like those people in Lotus Lands to do that. A second kind of statement is that the walk has become predictable and peace demonstrations in general have become almost an everyday occurrence, so that the peace walk here would be covered in national media only, quote, if all hell broke loose, such as, for example, if the walkers chose to occupy a military base or something. That would be considered newsworthy. And such observations are quite consistent with Gitlin's analysis of a rising threshold of coverage of protest and a consequent self-destructive escalation of rhetoric and of tactics on the part of the new left in the 60s. Thirdly, it was suggested to me that the peace movement does not merit coverage because it has basically failed to create a mass movement that can influence political reality, and it's not the job of the media to help them do that. That's very interesting, too, because it was quite clear in all the interviews I did, nobody amongst journalists expressed any willingness to break or even to bend the notions of journalistic objectivity to make peace an issue, even though in other contexts it's quite all right for the media to jump on a bandwagon and to actively promote events like Rick Hansen it's quite all right for them not to look for the other side of the story. I mean, who's going to speak against Rick Hansen? Right? You don't need to follow the same kinds of rules of balance and objectivity. But when it comes to the peace movement, they are applied. So, after all this, what can we say by way of a tentative conclusion? Well, it does appear that the Vancouver media appear to have somewhat depoliticized the peace walk and instead to have framed it as a broadly based, nonpartisan, and therefore nonpolitical community festival. Now, I don't see this as a number being done by the press on the peace movement. I think to a considerable extent, the walk itself lends itself to that kind of framing for at least two reasons. Firstly, it is, after all, an event and a spectacle. It's very easy to present it as such. And secondly, EAR's nature as a coalition and its efforts to make the walk broadly based has itself led to a blunting of the walk's specific political messages. It was suggested to me, and I think there's a lot to it, that in a certain sense, the End the Arms Race coalition has occupied a political space, has walked through a door that the media held open for it. We're going to give you positive, upbeat coverage so long as present yourselves as a community festival and don't make pointed political statements, so long as you blunt your own political edges. I mean, it's as if that is what has happened. So I would argue that the news coverage of the walk and the Vancouver Area Peace Movement has privileged what I earlier identified as one strand amongst three in the discourse of dissent. That is the universalist kind of moralist critique of, war is hell, we don't like war. It's what one of my research assistants came up with the phrase, generic peace, the no-name brand. It's something that's not linked to any particular political analysis or set of policies. Which is not to trivialize it or to dismiss the importance of that position and that kind of sentiment on the part of millions of people. But what I would want to say is that it's vulnerable to co-optation by the dominant discourse of the Cold War. Because all you have to do from a Cold War perspective is say, yes, of course, war is hell. We believe that too. We all want a universal fraternity or sorority of humanity. But the problem is those Ruskies, right? And in fact, to maintain peace, which is what we all want, what you have to do is maintain a strong structure of deterrence. And in fact, I've done several interviews with people in the military, several different people, each of whom have made the statement at one point in the interview that, the Canadian Armed Forces are Canada's biggest peace movement. I think that's a terrific quotation. It illustrates how that particular position of generic peace is vulnerable to co-optation by the dominant Cold War ideology. So the Vancouver press, I want to make clear, I'm not saying that the Vancouver press has fabricated its generic peace approach to the walk as its own invention. But the nature of the coverage can be interpreted, I would argue, in part as a strategy by the press to protect its own interests. Because, on the one hand, the local press cannot afford to antagonize the huge proportion of its own readership, which participates in or is sympathetic to the walk, so we do get upbeat, positive human interest stories about it. On the other hand, the press would be faced with a real dilemma if it publicized radical critiques of the arms race and the militarism embedded in social institutions. Such critiques might represent a fundamental challenge to the interest and worldview not only of media owners and advertisers, but I think more importantly, to the worldview of the official spokespeople and bureaucratic institutions, the primary definers, on which the press routinely relies as an efficient source of news. I think the press would undoubtedly like to avoid having to choose between the radical critique of a large portion of its audience and the conservative and official perspective of its sources. And the best strategy for avoiding such a choice is to depoliticize the walk. So I think I'll stop here. I think I've gone on for about 60 minutes. We should probably open it up for discussion. I guess it's possible for me to talk in more general terms about some of the other stages of the research and some of the overall conclusions that I think are emerging. I think it's I would not say that the Canadian press in any sort of monolithic way reflects or amplifies Cold War ideology. Certain versions of the peace movement, of the peace discourse, if you like, have made themselves felt in the press, but perhaps not always in the way that they would like. Yes, I think that's quite possible, and we don't know what the new, you know, city administration is going to do, but I think it would follow from this interpretation that if the city were to start defining this as to distance itself from the peace walk and to say that this is a political protest event and it's really not appropriate for us as a city government to be taking a political position on behalf of the whole population, some of whom might not agree with the statement being made by the walk. If the city were to do that and to then start defining the event as a political protest again rather than an all-inclusive community festival, I think the nature of the coverage would in turn begin to change.
Are you going to look at that? I mean, we're coming up to a peace walk.
Yeah, I wished I had time to get more involved than I can be right now with all these other deadlines facing me, as I'm sure you know about. But
Has the city said anything?
Hmm?
Has the city said anything?
As far as I know, they're still officially endorsing it, as far as I know.
I might just add that the city of Burnaby, mm-hmm. I appear before the council every year to entice or cajole them into taking a role in the march. But they've now gone so far as to endorse it.
Yeah.
They won't allow any of their symbols to be attached to any other to any aspect of the march, nor will they send any human representative.
That's your dog.
but they did. You say they did endorse it?
They will endorse it. The votes, there were four votes held, and the first the vote on endorsement passed with only one exception, and all the other votes were about the actual use of symbols, flags, banners, human representatives, and so on, or taking out ads, which would have to send this quote on. Another one, symbol on.
Yeah. Just by way of a footnote, one of the organizers of the walk, who recently has moved out of Vancouver but was heavily involved up until last year, said that before last year's walk, Mayor Harcourt and the chairman of the Vancouver Centennial Committee met with the Sun's editorial board and basically made a case for upbeat, positive, and extensive coverage of the walk as part of the centennial celebrations, I suppose. So to the extent that the Sun's editors take that kind of intervention seriously, presumably, those people are primary definers, if you like.
You made a number of statements about the prevailing ideology, which we did studies that have identified in newspaper, primarily newspaper, but media studies, media output. How do you see things like John Fraser's writing about the Chinese? How does that fit into the sort of dominant discourse about political war?
Well, I mean, to answer that, I'd have to be familiar with John Fraser's.
You don't know anything about his writing about China?
I've seen one or two articles ages ago, and I've got a book of his sitting on my shelf, but it's gathering dust, I'm afraid, at the moment. So if you could flesh it out, I might be able to respond.
Well, there was a sense in which he was, after all, wrote about ballet and wrote about the arts and so forth for the Globe and Mail, and he went to China and wrote about the struggles that were going on at the present at the time in China, and he, I think he cast, it was, I think the book was interesting insofar as it maintained some of the particularly racist ideas that we have of Chinese and so forth, but it did open up a different kind of discourse. I don't think you can answer the question unless you know what he wrote, so, but I just, I'm, you know, I it doesn't fit, to me, it doesn't fit at all what you're saying, and you're talking about a open system that is very constrained and develops in a certain way, the evil empire stuff, and us and them, and that, and I don't understand that that's...
It doesn't apply to China, you're saying?
No, I don't think it applies to a lot of things. I would have a hard time when you say things about Chile as part of what we describe as we, and it includes freedom. I don't see that's at all the case.
No, what I was trying to say is that there are competing discourses, all right? And the question I'm raising is the extent to which the media selectively draw from them and hierarchically structure them in their coverage. I was trying to, if you like, give you an ideal model of classic Cold War ideology as something that I have to do in order to make sense of how the media operate in relation to these discourses.
You said directly that we includes, and this is a number of countries, including Chile and some other countries.
According to classical Cold War ideology and its definition of who we are, I would argue that in this sort of ideal type, we is the free world. I mean, at its broadest. Right? And the free world, at least in American Cold War ideology, does include countries like Chile and South Korea.
Are you saying this ideal type then exists or doesn't exist? I mean, you set up an ideal, and then now you're telling me it doesn't exist? An ideal type?
Depends what you mean by exist. I mean, I think it's useful as a kind of heuristic device, if you like, for organizing the research. You've got to do, and I think there's all kinds of evidence one could support or one could point to, and there's other people in this room who are doing this kind of work. Looking at the analysis of nuclear texts in other areas, that this is an actual operative discourse, right? It's evident in certain kinds of texts, not necessarily Canadian newspapers directly, but in strategic writings of American deterrent theorists and so on.
Well, it seems to me it's a bit of an epistemological problem. You set up an ideal type and then you say it doesn't exist.
No. You're right. Neither real nor unreal. Somewhere in between.
You can't criticize an ideal type for either being right or wrong. But all it is this question whether it's useful or not useful.
I'm not saying, but if you set that up as a foundation for your analysis, then you're distorting. I mean, the difficulty with content analysis, of course, is where you start from and how you organize after that. Mm-hmm. And so if you start from an ideal type, which I can, I could say an ideal type exists, which is entirely different from what...
Oh, yeah, okay.
And so if you start from that ideal type and then you sort of organize where it does or does not conform, I mean, then it calls into question the whole basis of what you're up to.
Not if you see the ideal type as competing discourses and that as being a description of a discourse, not a description of anything else. I mean, what in political communication studies that I'm involved with, the whole question of competing discourses and negotiation over both terms and discourse is a central analytical tool. And then in the analysis of discourse, which is done either by content analysis, discourse analysis, or any very different ways, you attempt to get into the ways in which the discourses negotiate with each other and how that is put into practice by the actual people who are carrying on the discourse.
No, I would want to argue, although I don't have the evidence at hand, I mean, it's basically constructed through speaking to other people and interviews I've done with at least a dozen, if you like, deterrence theorists and military spokespeople and so on. But that was a reasonably accurate indication of how they see the world. And that therefore it is a useful model to use.
I was interested in your comments a couple of weeks ago on CBC when you were
talking about the issue was the orientation of the news and news production toward the East. And the question was the Eastern bias or Eastern domination of that, of news construction. You didn't exactly refute that notion, but you suggested that it was not the issue.
Yeah.
I wonder if you could address that issue again in terms of what you talked about here, and that is east of the Rockies. There was no coverage, virtually no coverage as far as you could ascertain, and the sentiments from these Eastern journalists about the nature of the peace march and the issue here is Vancouver based. In other words, if it's not, if the news production is not funneled through the East, certainly to a certain extent it is at CBC, the national, and token coverage of regions and such, to what extent does it inform the way it's covered regionally?
Yeah, assumptions of that Ontario is Canada.
Primarily,
I would argue, well, let's see, one point I would make is that had the Eastern media, I mean, this is itself a sweeping generalization, had the Toronto Star, for example, been confronted with a peace demonstration of the size of the one you have here in Toronto, it would have paid attention to that and would have done so in a fairly sympathetic way. And that, in turn, would lead it to pay more attention to the Vancouver Peace March as perhaps part of, you know, part of the operation of news values and of news judgment. Say, well, it's not just Vancouver, it's here as well. In fact, that same editor I spoke to at one of the Toronto papers, I've promised him anonymity, and for quite understandable reasons given what he was saying. Vancouver isn't like the real world, he said, but if people in Toronto or the United States or Western Europe made it an issue, made peace a major kind of political movement, then he would be interested. So I think there is that sort of perception, and it's really hard to tease out, that we have an idiosyncratic political culture in BC, similar perhaps to some extent to the way California is seen in the United States. And I think it has not only, I mean, there is some reality to it, right? It's not a complete fabrication. I mean, would the voters of any other province have elected Bill Vanderzaal? Can we honestly say that they would have? I don't know. I don't know if we can honestly say that they would have. So there's, and I've spoken to people here in the Vancouver media who say, yes, you know, we are a bit loony out here. There is something to it. But at the same time, I think there's organizational reasons, historically, at least in from the American literature that I'm aware of, why California tends to be stereotyped as the land of the bizarre and the strange. You can take it right back to the early days of TV news, when it was very difficult to report hard news coming out of California and get it back, you know, package the film and put it on the flight back to New York in time for processing for that evening's newscasts. So what you do when you want to report, you know, on California, which is after all a major market for the national networks, which you can't get today's hard news. Well, what you do is you do feature-type stories, which you can run tomorrow or the next day, and it doesn't really matter.
You know, they're I was going to say that it's related to just a question that comes out of this as well. Did you look at you made a lot of, most of your references were to the print media.
Yeah.
Did you consider, and I'm thinking if I remember the coverage of this on the national, did you consider the television coverage?
Yeah, no, that's something we have to forego altogether for purposes of this particular project, just because of both the cost and the logistics and the additional methodological problems of dealing with visual flow rather than just a print on a page. I mean, it's one way I would like to extend this research, actually, is to look not just at electronic media, but at genres of storytelling apart from news. To look at other aspects of popular culture, if you like, and how they would tie in with discourses for or against the Cold War. But I didn't get a chance to do it in this study. I did do, of course, as I mentioned, a content analysis with a lot of help from Amparo in particular, of 19 papers across the country. And I will have, once I get it out of the computer, evidence that will address sort of the regional specificity of coverage of peace and security matters. I would expect there to be some important differences.
And I like what you're saying in some kind of context. I've got a particular question. First, you mentioned Libya. How many planes failed to deliver their bombs in Libya?
I don't remember the answer to that one, I'm afraid. Two or three?
What papers did you read?
The three Toronto papers.
And so?
No, I'm sure it was mentioned, it just didn't come
to mind. So, okay, so the main question is the textual one. You talk about classic Cold War ideology in the U.S. and so on. How would you apply this to the situation in the Middle East?
That's an interesting one, and it does address the question of the American attack on Libya. What it raises the question of whether that, what I've identified as a classic Cold War paradigm, we must be strong to deter them, can in some ways be transferred to definitions of the other apart from the Soviet Union. And I think to some extent there is a kind of displacement or transferal, if you like, from the Soviet Union to quote-unquote Arab terrorists. That's a phrase I did come across in news coverage. A reference to Arab terrorism, I've yet to see a reference to European terrorists or North American terrorists or white terrorists. And that's how I would look at it, is to ask whether the other can be defined a little differently in the Middle East situation. There were, of course, continual implications or references to the Soviet Union being in the background, especially in a paper like the Toronto Sun, underlying the Gaddafi regime or underlying terrorist attacks.
Middle East, Israel, Syria, Kuwait, Iran, Iraq.
Yeah, well, I think. I think what is important is the definition of the other. That's what the question is trying to address.
How does this apply to the Middle East, for instance? How does it account for the United States' attitude to Iraq?
I don't know if I could address the question that way, but if you'll permit me, what I'd like to do is make an argument that the idea of the other can perhaps be applied to certain Arab regimes or perhaps to the Arab people as a whole. And I'd like to read, if I can, I really would like to share with you a particular article from the Globe and Mail.
But you haven't answered my question. What about Iran? Iran is not an Arab regime.
Well, I'm not sure that what would be...
Well, you're talking about classic Cold War ideology.
Mm-hmm.
The certain view of the world that you're putting forward, you say certain people hold this point of view, and I'm saying, okay, well, if this is the case, then presumably you know something about the way that point of view is applied to the situation in the Middle East, which is essentially the center of political conflict in the world. How is it related to Israel? You talk about Arab terrorists, well, this doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the Soviet Union whatsoever. It has to do with Israel. It has to do with racism.
Yeah.
Right? So...
Well, it may be. I mean, one possible answer is that the classic Cold War ideology doesn't really directly bear on interpretations of the Middle East.
But if it doesn't bear there, then it doesn't bear anywhere.
Isn't this the way in which terrorists are defined? I mean, this concept of others is interesting. Perhaps Iran, as an example, is defined in these terms, I would suggest, in terms of
Soviet. How does this classic Cold War ideology in which the Russians are the other and everybody else spins off of them, what has it got to do with reality today?
The fact of the matter is it creates a problem for them. So what they have to do, they have to try to deal with Iran and pretend that they were moderate in Iran. When that was over.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about Iran is an anti-Soviet country. So, what about the United States treatment of the two?
I won't say anything about that, but I just did find that there were one or two connections of both kinds of Soviet Union with both countries.
One way.
Look, this is the point. Who is on which side? Why in Iraq have the Americans been supporting the Iraqis and the Soviets as well? And how do your classic Cold War ideology fit?
Yeah, I'm going to avoid commenting on actual, maneuvers of the United States in foreign affairs. So I do want to keep my attention to press coverage of it, and I think that One way in which Cold War ideology, or Cold War ideologists, would attempt to deal with the situation is to link, I mean, is first of all to construct this image of international terrorism, and secondly, perhaps to link it with the classic enemy, the Soviet Union. And not everything will fit in that framework. I mean, certainly Reagan had no idea how to interpret the war between Argentina and Britain over a little walk in the Atlantic. I mean, it just didn't fit, I mean, into his worldview.
This is not true.
But, one more question there, and then we're going to go to Bob, and then we're going to go. So there was a question here.
The United States won the war in the Falklands for the British. Without the United States, it would have lost.
Bill?
You used
in your own what? I haven't really used scaling at all, actually. I mean, it's where you combine variables in order to come up with scores.
There's a whole bunch of different approaches. One that seems to me to be quick on some of the most different is agricultural realism. And the way it works is you get people to give them two political people or two ideas, two concepts that these people are 10 minutes apart. How far apart are you from X? How far are you from Y? How far is A from B? You look at one of the comparisons for this. And what you can do is produce a cognitive mapping of the person's map of the cognitive structure. And you can see which concepts are going to be close to one another and which ones are going to be apart. And this is fine techniques.
Actually, the data, the level of data that we're using, at least as we've coded it, is basically nominal. Just sorting things into categories without assigning numeric values to them. So, I did that partly deliberately because I didn't want to get too heavily into quantitative techniques. I was more interested in the idea of the overall news agenda, taken from the first concept I outlined earlier. But you're right, there may be things that I can do, even with using dummy variables or whatever, and making certain assumptions, there may be additional kinds of statistical procedures that I could apply even to nominal data.
But
let's just go back once again to the Cold War ideology question. I think that it's a nice idea for you to look for specific sites for the way it works out and the way that the ideology confronts forces that tend to disqualify. For example, if you look at the South African government, it historically has always viewed Cold War ideology to justify its forms of repression domestically. And they're not, they don't normally claim that these are Russians.
No.
They really say they're communists, the ANC and so on. And so, and yet that never gets very far because the South African government tends to disqualify itself from the justification that the Cold War ideology offers, right? That is because of this quote immoral regime. People don't take that kind of justification seriously. But if you look at Nicaragua, Reagan has gone a lot of mileage out of a Cold War ideology that's not, strictly speaking, so they're not strictly speaking Soviet proxies. He always links up as much as he can, but when push comes to shove, there's a residual sense that the Sandinistas are really Nicaraguans, they're really their own kind of communism, and you've got to get rid of. So there's this lingering sense that your original proposition was that the gone from a generic communism down to a Soviet war. But if you look in these little neighborhood battles or conflicts, they
dominant ideology does get this sort of counterforce at times. Doesn't
yeah.
lend itself to easy use.
Yeah, I think
it's
I see.
It's not always amenable to simply
and you're saying that there is certainly at least a residual sense that the older notion of communism as an ideological force is itself the other against which we mobilize. Yeah. The reason I suggested that it's harder to do that now is precisely because of the split between China and the Soviet Union in the 60s. And that supposedly we're now friends with a Chinese communist regime. Well, trading partners, yeah. No, but if you look at certainly in the United States, the treatment of China in popular movies.
Canada. I mean, I remember specifically because I was in the United States when people were amazed that Canada had friendly relations
yeah.
with China. So
right.
when you say we, you
okay, but I was saying in China, it wasn't so long ago that at least in the United States, which I see as sort of the heartland of classical Cold War ideology. just a second. It wasn't so long ago that China was treated as the enemy. I can recall films coming out around 1970, which portrayed Soviets and Americans cooperating in order to undermine or to deter a threat from the Chinese. But the question, Bob, you're raising about whether the notion of communism in general is still...
It's so all-embracing that it's constantly amenable to local interpretations and utilization. And I mean, yes, but with these qualifications, governments and movements can make use of the Cold War ideology because of its amorphous.
Mm-hmm.
You call it Manichaean, but it's also this. It's incontrovertible. The purpose system has always been there.
Yeah.
So
that's right.
It's amenable, but there are limitations on its use.
Yes, I agree. The big question that, I mean, I haven't really addressed in my research, but I mean, that bears a lot of thinking, is about whether other definitions of the enemy could substitute for the notion of Soviet expansionism and still use the same sort of basic ideological structure to legitimize the arms race and military spending and so on. To some extent, I think that the notion of international terrorism is used sort of for similar purposes of ideological mobilization. But it's hard to use international terrorism as a justification for a massive nuclear arsenal. So, I mean, I think it's only so far you can take it.